NPR. Good evening and welcome to the Local Edition. I'm your host, Genevieve Hartnett. Jason Dole has the night off, but we have a lot to get into on the show tonight, so let's not waste any time. In the second half of the show, we'll get into updates around Sullivan County's ongoing discussion about building the Gateway Housing Project to address ongoing homelessness. Before that, September is Prostate Awareness Month. We'll learn all about free prostate screenings that Garnet Health is offering this week. But we'll start tonight with a piece from New York Focus, who recently reported that ICE detentions in New York's county jails have skyrocketed this year, nearly six times more than in all of 2024. Seven jails across the state are now holding people for federal immigration authorities, raising questions about money, politics, and the human impact of these agreements. Radio Catskill's Patricio Roballo spoke to New York Focus reporter Julia Rock about this story and what is causing the surge.
People have been seeing it in the news. ICE has been increasing the number of immigration arrests it's doing as part of President Donald Trump's promise to ramp up immigration enforcement and deport all types of people. So that's the easy answer, is just that ICE is arresting more people. And, you know, when ICE and other federal law enforcement arrest people, they need somewhere to hold them. One thing that's worth noting is that we're seeing this increase in detentions in New York. I'm sure your listeners have seen the news about new detention facilities getting constructed in the South in places like Louisiana, Texas, Florida. A lot of times when people are arrested in New York, they'll spend some time in a county jail here under this administration before being transferred to a different facility.
And I see in your article some counties have long worked with ICE, but others have joined just this year. I see, of course, the article, Orange and Clinton County has consistently held federal immigration detainees. And the article states that since February, Broome, Montgomery, Nassau, Niagara, some other counties have sort of joined this group here. Why now? Why have those sort of answered a little bit before, but why have those counties sort of jumped on the, lack of a better word, the bandwagon for this thing?
Yeah, well, so two things to take note of are, first, that ICE really only has one big federal detention facility in New York, in Batavia, which is near Buffalo. And that facility, as ICE has increased arrests this year, has often been at capacity or even over, you know, what its capacity is supposed to be. So it's a really overcrowded. And so ICE has been taking people to other upstate jails, you know, in the absence of being able to take people to Batavia. That's also a men's only facility. So sometimes, you know, when women are arrested near Buffalo, they'll be taken to a jail for some time instead. And then the other thing to take note of is that New York does not allow private detention centers. And ICE is somewhat unique in that it relies really heavily on privately run detention facilities. And so for that reason, there's not sort of, another new facility being built or being opened by a private contractor, which has meant that as ICE increased arrests but doesn't really have additional capacity in the places where it had been detaining people in recent years, they've turned to other jails that were willing to hold ICE detainees to sort of help with this increased enforcement and deportation effort they're undertaking.
Right. And one thing I always love about New York Focus's reporting is this: you guys have charts, and I love charts and seeing all this data here. And one thing that sort of stood out to me was the amount of how long ICE detainees are spending in New York jails. And I'll bring up Orange County because this is the closest county to us. It seems that they are spending at least 33 days in Orange County. Why do the amount of days spent in these sort of varies from county to county? Why does it vary so much?
Yeah, so what we're seeing with some of the jails is that they're really only being used as places to sort of hold people for a couple of days until they're immediately transferred to somewhere else. And with the way ICE and other federal agencies involved in immigration enforcement are operating, especially now, there are just so many facilities involved in detention, and they move people around quite a bit. And it appears as though, you know, based on the data and the reporting we did, that some jails are really being just used as places where people are held for a couple of days, where they're taken to a bigger facility that maybe sort of has a longer standing relationship with ICE. And some are used as more like long-term facilities where people might, you know, call into court hearings virtually from those facilities. They might sort of await an entire court proceeding from detention there. So that's historically that's been true of Orange County. People spend more time there, and that's definitely been true this year. It's not just one of these facilities where people are taken for a few days before they can be brought somewhere else, but it's a, you know, slightly more permanent detention situation.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk about the money that's involved here, because obviously this is not free. Someone has to pay for these people to be there. And how does those agreements work financially? Like, how, if you want to go, let's say Orange County, how much revenue is coming in for the counties for these detentions in these jails?
Totally. So the way these agreements tend to work is that ICE or whatever federal agency has the contract with the facility basically pays a per person per day amount. And so for jails in New York, we found that amount is as low as $95 a day or as high as $195 a day. For jails that have been holding, a few people at a time this spring, that doesn't add up necessarily to a significant part of the jail budget, but Orange County holds, you know, in recent years and this year, a much higher number of people than some of these smaller jails. And so it actually adds up to being, you know, a somewhat significant revenue stream. And some of the sheriffs we spoke to for these articles, you know, who run the jails and tend to really be in charge of the decision of whether to take ICE detainees and how to work with ICE, seem to really, you know, welcome that revenue as, you know, helping cover jail costs and operations.
Yeah, you spoke to one activist, Jim Schultz, an activist of Stand Up Lockport in Niagara County. This quote he has there is, they're just doing it for the money. What else the county jails are going to get used to for just this money? So, yes, some of these counties are getting a significant amount of a revenue stream from these detainees.
Yeah, I think there, you know, we've certainly in speaking with activists and folks in some of these counties, I think there's a lot of, you know, people who are more generally opposed to either big picture, the ICE enforcement regime that's currently underway and the form it's taken under Trump, as well as just, having people who are swept up in this immigration system, which isn't really a criminal system. It's, you know, for civil violations being held in criminal jails. I think one concern they've had is that counties are just doing this for the revenue stream. And that's, in their eyes, not a legitimate reason to, you know, be partaking in a system that they more generally oppose.
Yeah. And another thing that stood out in this article, that Montgomery County legislature didn't realize that this was happening in her county. Maria Kowalikas, I don't know, hope I pronounced her right name, last name right, but she didn't know about this until New York Focus, until you reached out to her for comment. And I'm just surprised about that I guess this was going on without, I guess, everyone knowing within, I guess, the legislature or whatever government body that's governing the county. Was that surprising to you also, or?
I mean, yeah, I think it certainly points to the way that this detention has been happening. You know, in recent years, I think it became pretty widely known that Orange County and Clinton County were holding ICE detainees. There was a lot of attention from activists and some state legislators to stop those detention agreements. There was concerns about what the conditions were in those jails. But this year, as new counties have started holding ICE detainees, it hasn't necessarily, I think in Nassau, the county officials have been, you know, very open in saying they're doing this. It's really been unmistakable given the number of people they've been detaining. But in some of the smaller upstate jails, it doesn't seem like there was ever a point where they, you know, made an announcement this was something they were going to start doing, you know, and had public debate about it or something like that. It was more that they had, you know, longstanding agreements with the federal government that allowed them to start doing this. It seems like the sheriffs just have a very large amount of discretion in how they want to move forward with these agreements. There wasn't necessarily a lot of public understanding, you know, initially as they started holding ICE detainees about what was happening and what the consequences of that might be.
Wow. Right. Just before we, you know, before we go, we're wrapping up here, but what does the data show about who is actually, is it being detained? Is it all males? Is it families? How is that sort of makeup made?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know exactly what the gender breakdown is. As I mentioned, the Batavia facility, is the big ICE facility near Buffalo, is only for men. And so we've heard anecdotally that, you know, women who are people who are being held in the county jails are more likely to be women. For example, I've heard that with the Niagara County Jail. One data point about who's been moving through the system that I think has mattered a lot to people is ICE has often, you know, depicted its enforcement efforts as really being targeted towards, you know, people with criminal convictions. But more than half of the people who have been held in New York jails for ICE so far this year didn't have any, they weren't facing any criminal charges and they'd never have a criminal conviction. So one thing we do know about the people moving through the ICE network in New York, as it were, is about half of them, you know, have never had any criminal charges against them.
This is interesting. Julia, before we go, is there anything else I have not touched on you want folks to know about your article?
You know, you asked some great questions. I think it's just worth highlighting what you said at the beginning, that this is a really significant increase from, you know, just last year, the number of people being held by ICE in New York County jails. It is something that's happened historically. You know, it's not a new thing for a lot of New York jails to hold people for ICE. But just, you know, compared to the last couple of years, it's a really significant increase right now. And I think, you know, there are certainly consequences. Something we heard from attorneys is that it just becomes, you know, much harder to find people, get them access to counsel when they're being held in a jail or you don't know where they're being held. So we're still trying to figure out exactly what the consequences of this, you know, are for people being held by ICE, for people trying to represent them. But I think that's certainly part of the story as well.
Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to your reporting. And also, you wrote this report, this article with Isabella Taft, who covers immigration for New York Focus. So again, we were talking to Julia Rock, a reporter for New York Focus, about the increase of ICE detainees in local jails and county jails, and which have exploded this year. Again, Julia, thank you so much for this. I do really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on. I always appreciate that as well.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
Thank you so much to Julia Rock for your reporting. Moving right along, September is National Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, and Garnet Health is offering free prostate screenings in Middletown on Thursday, September 25th and Friday, September 26th. To talk about why these screenings matter, what men can expect, and how early detection can save lives, Radio Catskill's Patricio Roballo spoke with Dr. Samuel Aborbi, urologist with Garnet Health Doctors and chair of Garnet Health Urology Department.
Why is Garnet offering these screenings for free?
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and it's a pleasure to talk about Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, because we at Garnet care deeply about men's health. And so that's the main reason why we're offering free screenings. We care about our population. We care about the men in our communities, and we want them to be in the best health that they can be. And so, as you mentioned, September is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. We want to bring attention to this disease, and we want to bring attention to the fact that it's very common, but also very treatable if caught early. And so that's the whole goal of these screening clinics.
If you want to understand more, because you said a lot already there about prostate health and why it's important for early detection of prostate cancer.
So what I want to impress upon your listeners is basically that the prostate, all men have one, and they all tend to act up as we get older. And when I say act up, that can basically occur in one of two ways. Probably most men will realize as they get older, they'll have more trouble urinating, and that could be waking up at night to urinate, or having to push somewhat, or noticing a weak stream, or having to go to the restroom often. Those are typical things that we see in men as they get older, but it does not necessarily indicate that they have prostate cancer, right? That is a sign probably that the prostate is getting enlarged, but again, that's not necessarily indicating cancer. The key thing is that for prostate cancer, especially in its early stages, there are virtually no, and so I don't want men to think that, hey, I'm peeing great compared to my buddy, so therefore I can't have prostate cancer. Not at all. There's really, in the early stages, virtually no warning signs, which is why it's so important to go to your doctor to get a screening.
And Garnet is offering these screenings twice this month, one on September 25th, another on September 28th at the Outpatient Services Building in 707 East Main Street in Middletown. And you're looking for men between the ages of 45 and 75, and no personal history of prostate cancer, and not have been under their
right
care of urologists in the past 5 years.
Correct. So you're asking about the, you know, why we're offering it for this mm-hmm. age group. And so, you know, the main reason is that if we look at the range from 40 to 75, so on the lower end, it's very, very unlikely to have prostate cancer below age 40. It's usually a disease of middle age and older men. Not that it's impossible, as we say in medicine, nothing is impossible, but it's extremely unlikely. Now, there might be certain rare situations, like, for example, if there's an extremely strong history in your family where every man has had prostate cancer, that you might want to get checked even below age 40, but that's very unlikely. Then if we go to the opposite end of the spectrum, for men really above 75 to 80, we see that these men are actually less likely to benefit from the treatments of prostate cancer. And so we don't want to subject them to the process of going through a diagnosis and treatment if, you know, the cure for the disease is really not going to prolong their life. So that's why we've chosen the age of 40 to 75 for screening.
Can you describe for our listeners sort of the screening process and what is it like for someone coming in for one of these free screenings at Garnet?
Yes. So first of all, it's important to know that it's very quick. I mean, the whole process is probably about 2 minutes. And the process entails a quick physical exam where we basically touch the prostate and we can get a sense within a matter of seconds if there's anything abnormal. And then the second is a blood test. Mm-hmm. And there's no need to be fasting. It's just a small amount of blood that's drawn by an expert phlebotomist or blood drawer. And after that, they're free to go.
So, you know, what would you say to someone who might feel nervous or uncomfortable about getting screened?
I come across this situation pretty much every day, Patricio. So it's something that I've been seeing commonly for the past 10 years. So people should know that this is almost like a universal type of reaction. It's a normal reaction. It's the unknown. You know, people don't necessarily know what prostate cancer is, and they may have some predetermined idea of what, you know, testing is involved. Some people think that the screening involves putting large cameras in their behinds. It's not that. It's a quick rectal exam and a quick blood test. So the testing part is relatively quick and straightforward. And then the information that you gather from that is very helpful. And I always say to patients, knowledge is power. It's better to know what's happening in your body so you can actually be informed about what's going on as opposed to always having a doubt in the back of your mind.
Absolutely. And those, and I understand that pre-registration is required. So I just want to give out the address here is garnethealth.org/prostate screening, or you could call 845-333-1133. And they're saying appointments are limited, and it's a first come, first serve basis there.
Yes, that is my understanding. Correct.
Yeah. You know, let's talk about that. If someone does get a result that might need a follow up, what happens next?
Typically, we mail the results to patients within a few weeks, and on there it'll say what their PSA number is. And if it's of concern, then we'll recommend further workup with the urologist of their choice. And I'm happy to see them in our clinic. I have a partner as well, Dr. Galarno, that sees patients for prostate issues, or they can choose any local urologist that might be familiar with. We just want people to be aware and people to get screened. That's the most important thing for us.
Thank you so much again to Patricio for your reporting. We'll take a quick break, but coming up, we'll have an update about housing in the Catskills. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Welcome back to the Local Edition. I'm Genevieve Hartnett. The Gateway Housing Project was rejected by the Sullivan County Legislature for the second time last Thursday. Advocates say the project would help alleviate the county's homelessness crisis and have spoken about it passionately at the weekly meetings in Monticello. Sullivan County's Health and Human Services Department has been working with the community and the legislature to secure a location for the site, but the clock has run out for state funding to the project. Amidst the high tensions and looming deadlines, I spoke with John Little, Sullivan County Health and Human Services Commissioner, about the work his department is doing to address the crisis and concerns from the community. Can you first talk about how you came into your position that you're in right now and how you've seen the issue with housing change throughout your tenure in Health and Human Services?
So I've been the Social Services Commissioner for a little more than 5 years now. And as far as how the housing issue has developed in Sullivan County over the last 5 years, I have seen nothing but change. Most recently, we've really done a lot of work to get families transitioned into permanent housing. That's been our primary focus, although we're certainly helping everybody. But through that work, we hit an 18-month low back in the beginning of August this year. That put us at 260. Unfortunately, we've seen another really massive spike this month. We're not sure why we've seen it this month in particular. We have noted, though, a lot more first-time folks, young folks coming in for homeless services. So we're back up to 297 was our total last week. And that number is the number of people we are providing emergency shelter services to in Sullivan County. So that number has been, like I said, in my five-year tenure, it's been all over the place.
Can you talk about some of the mental health services that you do offer for people, for families, and how you feel that the issues of mental health and homelessness are intertwined?
I would say, first of all, there is a shortage of providers for mental health nationwide. Sullivan County is no different, but we certainly are doing our best to expand those services. And one of the things that we've been able to do is we've been able to improve our hiring and staffing at the county. And we are able to offer open access to the county's mental health clinic here in Liberty so that folks can just walk in, no appointment needed, on Tuesday and Thursday mornings. And then we schedule folks for follow-on appointments after that. But that's, we're seeing utilization of that increase significantly. To the challenge of mental illness and homelessness in particular, I would say that they're not one and the same, but obviously there's a lot of overlap on those issues. It's something that we have gotten specific assistance from the State Office of Mental Health on, and we have what's called a Safe Options Support Team. It's staffed by folks from Rehabilitation Support Services and Independent Living, and we have a team of four folks that goes out into the street to do outreach with folks. These are folks who are peers, or there's a clinical social worker on the team specifically trained to help folks who are experiencing homelessness with their various mental health needs to help get them transitioned into permanent housing. And that's been active for about a year now. And we're really pleased with the success that that's had in terms of getting people to engage.
Just coming up to the vote in April, the 8-1 vote that shot down this proposal, it seemed like it had very widespread public support, and the legislators who did support it spoke about it very passionately. Were you surprised to see it be rejected? And, or could you tell certain people were maybe more opposed to it?
What I would say is that as I've spoken with the members of the legislature, the feedback I've gotten back is that in general, they actually, all nine of them, are in favor of the concept. The challenge is the site, and the site becomes a very intense local political constituent issue.
What exactly about the location is the issue?
There are concerns from neighbors, which is the common issue we see across the country. It's not even as simple as not in my backyard. There are certain elements of that where folks are concerned about having a homeless shelter in their neighborhood. But there have also been concerns raised by the legislature of, if we're worried about not in my backyard, let's not isolate this thing so much from civilization that the folks can't get the services they need. So there's definitely a balance there that the legislature's been debating and discussing.
The most recent grant at the end of August that was approved by the Department of Planning, is that at all related to this, or would it help to potentially get this proposal off the ground and into a better location that would work for everybody?
What I would tell you is that this is all one big issue, housing continuum. Folks that study this issue a lot know that there's a whole range of housing that a community needs to function, from emergency shelter all the way up to enough market rate housing to support a growing economic development in the community. So those are programs designed to get more housing built that is both market rate, but also as a condition of receiving funds from county government, you provide some affordability for tenants as well. And that's important because, again, you have to fill across the whole socioeconomic spectrum in order to alleviate these issues. Because even if, from my perspective in social services, obviously we are focused on homelessness and those who are the most poor. But when folks with some means don't have housing, decent housing stock to buy, and they're buying quote unquote fixer uppers, that's how gentrification happens. That's how cost is driven up for lower income folks. And so that causes issues all around. So from my perspective, although my daily focus is on homelessness, I want to see the whole housing continuum improved, because inevitably you do something for the other end of the spectrum, it's going to help the lower end as well.
Hi, everyone. This is me cutting back in because there have been some major housing updates after my conversation with John Little a few weeks ago. Last Wednesday, New York's Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance, or OTDA, suspended applications for the state's Homeless Housing and Assistance Program, or HHAP, which is the main program that Sullivan County was looking to apply for to fund the facility. The next day, at the Sullivan County Legislative Meeting in Monticello, a new location for the housing project was rejected again, this time in a 5-4 vote against building the site at Sunset Lake Road in Liberty. The suspension notice from OTDA said that it was going to only be taking applications from existing shelters. In a statement to Radio Catskill, the OTDA said that the pause in funding was, quote, in anticipation of soon awarding up to $125 million in available funding that was included in the state fiscal year 2026 budget. HHAP expects to resume accepting such applications when additional funding is available, unquote. Even in the face of a divided legislative council and a community wondering what is taking so long to address the housing crisis, John Little is not giving up. He's willing to work with both the state and county to address the housing continuum. Here's what he had to say.
The funding for these programs is difficult. There's a lot of state grant funding available to us for this emergency shelter, but we have to decide on a site as a county first, because obviously the state isn't going to cut us a check for nothing. So we have to sort those issues out on our end. And once we do that, then I feel like we have built pretty strong relationships with New York State, OTDA, OMH, in particular, those two agencies help us generate more housing opportunities, safe and stable, sober housing opportunities for our community.
Thank you very much for talking with me this evening, John.
Thank you.
In Liberty, I'm Genevieve Hartnett for Radio Catskill. And that's it for the local edition this evening. If you'd like to get more updates about the legislative meeting last week and the ongoing housing debate, our reporter Kimberly Izar has also done great work on this issue that's available on our website, wjffradio.org. Thank you so much for listening and for trusting us to tell you the news. Take care of yourselves and each other. Have a great night, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Support comes from Country House Realty, a boutique brokerage specializing in the best of Sullivan County. Country House Realty, offering exceptional spaces in beautiful places. More at countryhouserealty.com. And from listeners like you.
If it's happening here, it's on Radio Chatskill. Local events, local voices. Live local conversations 5 days a week. Radio Chatskill. Weekday mornings at 10.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.